Welcome to the section on conflict management. I will talk today about preventing conflicts and managing conflicts. And in the beginning, I will say something about can we forecast political conflict and in this way prevent them from occurring at all. I will briefly mention the role of the UN in these processes. Then in the second part, I will focus heavily on mediation, which is the most frequent conflict management technique. The last part of today's session will be on peacekeeping and interventions. When we look at conflict management, we can classify the different strategies, whether they have a long-term perspective and should appease the situation in the long term, or whether they are really then short-term solutions, like trying to find a ceasefire, an agreement on a ceasefire, for instance, between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh. If we first focus on the short-term conflict management strategies, then we can also think about the strategies that intervene directly in the conflict or the indirect ones. The focus today will be largely on the direct ones, and at least in the beginning, then on short-term conflict management strategies. And recall that conflict is a bargaining process. In a bargaining process, in the most simple interactions, you have two parties, here A and B. And quite often there is uncertainty about what the costs of conflict are, or uncertainty about other aspects of this interaction. Because of this, we do not know how large the bargaining space is. And the conflict cannot really be resolved if the status quo is in between the ideal points of the actors. And in such a situation, then an intervener, and here I speak largely about a mediator, takes an important role by trying to convince the sides that there is indeed a bargaining space and they should give up using force against each other. And so the second part of it then will focus on this kind of interaction, but this is also the situation for many other conflict management strategies. What you also have here is obviously the situation that in order to prevent a conflict from erupting, then actors might anticipate that in a certain situation, the varying parties might use force, and one has then an incentive to prevent that. And quite often here, the UN becomes active. And this is a slide which I already have used in another session. You have here the Security Council as the most active actor. And you see here that the situation has changed very much during the Cold War. We have experienced fewer vetoes, and we have seen an explosion in peacekeeping. And I will then focus on peacekeeping later on today. The Security Council is not the only actor. There is a recent paper by Clayton Doroson and Böhmelt. They have looked at the peace initiatives from 1946 to 2015 that the UN initiated. And you see here then that also the General Assembly plays a big role. What you also see here on this slide that the activities of the General Assembly and the Security Council and to some extent also the Secretary General are separated from each other. If there is an establishment initiative through the General Assembly, then it's quite likely that it is also authorized through the General Assembly. And the same is the case for equivalent initiative by the Security Council. The Secretary General plays, as you know, a lesser role. It establishes a certain initiative, but it needs to be authorized then most often through the Security Council. What were these changes that were going on since the end of the Cold War? I have said that there has been an explosion in peacekeeping, fewer vetoes, and this led then to more interventions of the UN. And you see this in the slide in the left bottom here in an article from Birdslip and Schmidt from 2012. They have examined then interventions in international crises, and this is insofar important that these crises have not yet necessarily escalated into the usage of armed force. But they also then distinguish here are what they call parochial interests. And here they mean that what are the roles or the interests of the permanent members of the Security Council. As you will recall and as you will know, the permanent members of the Security Council are the ones who have the means to veto any initiative here. And there is, as you see here on the other slide, here that these permanent members exert their vetoes not as often as before. What you also see here is that here the covariates change, for instance. So you see here that it matters or not on whether or not a crisis country entertains then a defense pact with one of the permanent members of the Security Council. And here you see a transformation. This has become a lot less important since then. What they also say is that after the end of the Cold War, what they call the organizational mission variables have become much more important. And this you see to the right in the bottom right figure here. So you see here an increase in deployments, in involvements, especially if the number of actors is high, if the level of violence is high. It's not only the permanent members that influence here conflict management. There are other interests that play a role. But you can still say that if high interests of a permanent members are at stake in a conflict around the world, then it's quite likely that the UN, that the United Nations will not intervene forcefully in this particular conflict. This is what you see here on the slide here. And what is noticeable that since the end of the Cold War, the UN gets involved in two more complex conflict situations, and it has adapted its strategy to that. What it has also adapted is the concept, or invented the concept and uses it, a movement towards human security. So it's not the security of states that play then in this official declarations a role, but after the fiasco in Rwanda, where it could not prevent then the genocide, UN policy moved to this new doctrine, which is R2B, responsibility to protect. And it wants to act timely and decisively and to intervene in advance. This is then obviously linked to the question on whether or not we can predict political violence. And here you see a cartoon about George W., who is depicted as this dumb head who does not understand that an intervention in Iraq, like the one he ordered, might then lead to a civil war in this particular country. Okay, so the question of prevention, of prediction, became much more urgent after the genocide in Rwanda. And there were some reports, you see here, a note by an observer who says that they also believes that the modern force of 5,000 troops drawn primarily from one country and sent to Rwanda could have significantly altered the outcome of the conflict. So, I mean, having UN forces on the ground, boots on the ground, as the Americans said, say, could have changed this particular conflict from escalating and could have reduced humanitarian catastrophe at least to a certain extent. What we need to understand here and what we need to distinguish here are, and I already mentioned these terms once, are ex-ante and exposed forecasts. Exposed forecasts are the easy forecasts, so you have certain data and you try to predict what happens inside this set of data points. Ex-ante forecasts are the true forecasts when you forecast into the future. And this is then linked to early warning. And nowadays, quite some governments around the world, also the German Foreign Office, but also the European Union, they have early warning units, which do not nothing else than to provide forecasts to decision makers in order to intervene early and to prevent a conflict from erupting further. But then I will, now we'll present are just some influential studies on where researchers have tried to figure out whether we can predict ex ante political conflict. Here is the study by Jack Goldstone and colleagues, and this comes out of the Minorities of War project, which had then as a side project the so-called state failure project. So what the attempt here is to predict political instability. And what they say here is that they were able to predict here certain escalations ex ante successfully. And they say that 4 out of 5 cases were predicted correctly by the model that they were using. What you have here in any such scheme, in any such early warning scheme, you need to distinguish between false positives and false and negatives. So what they also have predicted here are quite some false positives, conflicts that and faces of instability that did not materialize. So this is a general problem, but one could say that, okay, false positives are not such a big problem. The false negatives would be the ones we are interested in. Another way to look at conflict is to look at the systemic level and then just to predict how much war we observe in the future. And this is what Howard Hegre and colleagues in Scandinavia have done. So they have predicted then how many minor or major conflicts will occur in the world for a time span of 40 years. And they are quite optimistic in their forecasts. As you see on the slide here, there is a steady decline in the number of forecasts. Obviously, one can question such forecasts with a very long time horizon. And the problem here you see already in the figures that you have more or less a linear trend. You do not have these ups and downs as you had before hand. Forecasting political violence should have rather a short-term perspective because there are too many intervening forces over the long run. And you see this also reflected through the large confidence intervals. And you have here 80% confidence intervals. So this is why in one paper with two former students, we have looked at the risk that large-scale genocides would happen in the early phase of the Syrian civil war. And what we have relied here on is a specific assumption about the statistical probability that certain large-scale events occur. In such an instance, one should not look at or assume that there is a normal distribution in the size of wars, but also in the size of massacres against civilians. So you have a normal distribution, for instance, for the height of people or the speed of cars, but not when you look at the population of cities around the world. What you have here to introduce is then, or can use, our other distribution, like for instance the power law distribution. And you see this in the lower part of the figure. The right figure in the lower part shows then the logarithmized scale. And when you logarithmize this, then if there is really a power law distribution, this should be almost a linear decline then. And so the attempt was to figure out whether the logic of one-sided violence in Syria follows a power law distribution or not. So what we did was both to make ex post and ex ante forecasts. And we predicted then, as you see here to the left, the probability that large-scale massacres would occur. And you see here that for the very large massacres, the probability of occurrence is steadily declining. You also see here then how certain we are about these forecasts through the confidence intervals. Something similar we did then for predicting into the future based on the distributional assumptions on whether or not, or what was the probability of massacres of different sizes. And you see here again that these probabilities are relatively small for very large scale massacres. So the Syrian civil war is a very, very bloody civil war, but when you take the individual events, you have relatively few massive massacres, but we still believe that this was a worthwhile endeavor. One of the co-authors of this article, Aaron Closet from the University of Colorado at Boulder and the Santa Fe Institute, developed algorithms to predict then ex post the probability of 9/11, the terror attack in New York and Washington, D.C. And the probability here was then lower than the probability we predicted ex post for the Srebrenica massacre during the civil war in Bosnia. What you see here on these figures, this is just what has happened beforehand when you logarithmize the distribution of all events, then you should get this linear falling trend. And you see here that, unlike for the Syrian case, for the Bosnian civil war, the distribution follows much more of the different events, follows much, much more here a power law distribution. This is current research. I'm involved in a project by Howard Hegre, where we try to predict here then the risk of conflict at the sub-state level, but also at the country level, and we use Africa. And the first article where we tried to predict this was published in the Journal of Peace Research last year. And you see here, just from the byline to the article, that quite some people are involved in this project. So this is ongoing research, but it might be interesting for you to take a look at it. Okay, for the mini break before we move towards the study of mediation, I would like you to take a look at what is called in the literature also the Lucas critique, an important criticism of macroeconomic models and macroeconomic interventions. And Robert Lucas said in the 1960s and 1970s, he developed formal models that only unanticipated policy interventions will lead to behavioral changes. In the end, and this is then my question, does this make social interactions unpredictable or not? And as an aside, you see here the somehow sad anecdote about his Nobel Prize, that he had to share it with his former wife because she insisted on a clause in the divorce settlement. Welcome back. In this second part, I will talk about mediation. This mediation is the most frequent conflict management strategy. But we can also distinguish between other forms of short-term conflict management, peacekeeping, and interventions are other forms. All three forms presuppose that the conflict could not be prevented, or at least could not be prevented that a further escalation stage was reached. So it was necessary for someone then to act as a conflict manager. Obviously, if you have two conflict parties, they can also negotiate about a possible peace agreement, about the ceasefire themselves. But empirically speaking, mediations are more frequent than such negotiations. They are also more frequent than situations of arbitration. So, mediation and arbitrations have different connotations in the English usage than in the German usage. In German, you have the term, or the equivalent term for arbitration, which is Schlichtung. In international conflicts, arbitration means that the settlement that the conflict manager proposes and then implements is binding for the other sides. So this also is the reason why for sovereign states, they rarely agree on an arbitration as a conflict management strategy. And that was after World War II, over the status of Trieste, the northern Italian town, there was an arbitration and it was binding for the conflict parties, Yugoslavia and Italy. Then mediation is much more frequent. And this is a voluntary process. And most often it's a process in which either other states or international governmental organizations are involved. And here, obviously, the UN plays an important role through its Secretary General or other actors, but also the European Union. Here you see the different stages of mediation and also a definition of what mediation means by Jacob Berkovich, my co-author, who has over the years made frequent contributions to the mediation literature and has also assembled one of the first mediation data sets. So he defined mediation as a process of conflict management where disputants seek the assistance of or accept an offer of help from an individual group, state, or organization to settle their conflict or resolve their difference without resorting to physical force or invoking the authority of the law. Either the disputants can seek a mediator or some potential conflict manager makes an offer to settle this particular conflict. So this is what is you can see here on the figure. First, a mediator is then chosen, and then the second stage, if a mediation takes place, the mediator has to think about the strategies that it should be adopted to resolve this particular conflict. Then, as a result from this, if you think in binary terms, you have either a peaceful resolution or not. There are frequent examples of mediations, especially from the Middle East. And the Middle East is obviously one of the regions of the world where violent conflict is most frequent. And you know about some of these mediation attempts. So starting with Camp David agreement, where President Carter played a big role, and you had the main disputants, and also here President Sadat from Egypt and Prime Minister Begin from Israel. 14 years later, different prime minister in Israel, Rabin, different president from the US, Clinton, and Yasser Arafat from the PLO. The Dayton Agreement was the settlement then for the Bosnian civil war. Why is it called Dayton? Dayton is an air base in Ohio, and this is where then the Clinton presidency organized here the negotiations between the different conflict parties. Why did they choose Dayton? Also to show here the disputants, including President Milosevic from Serbia, that these are the airplanes that might be used against further if you do not agree on a peaceful settlement of the conflict. Here is based on an update of the Berkovich data set, just there are some descriptive statistics, and you see here that IGOs are most frequently involved, followed by large governments, meaning the United States, and other major powers. What is relatively seldom are peace or mediation attempts undertaken by private individuals. Also, the leader of international organizations are quite often not directly involved. It's rather other civil servants that become active on this scene. Here you see, again, based on the mediation data set by Berkovich, here in an article where Carl de Ruin from the University of Alabama and Paulina Pospnieca from Poznan University are included as co-authors, just the frequency distribution for the different outcomes of mediation attempts. And you see here unsuccessful 24 partial settlements, 18%. But if you take everything together, you have a success rate which is larger than 50%. Looking at more descriptive evidence here, just some anecdotes and about here first Oslo peace process, and this started out with negotiations between private individuals from the Palestinian side and from the Israeli side, and they negotiated very tentatively in Oslo. And the Norwegians were obviously quite proud about that when it turned out to be successful. Why did they choose these private individuals, independent academics, for conducting these negotiations? This is quite easy to understand, because in case that these negotiations, early negotiations, fail, then it's easy for the representatives of the Palestinians, but also for the Israeli government to say, okay, we were not informed about these particular developments here. So it's easy then to shift the blame to these irresponsible academics. To put it differently, such mediations quite often start from the bottom and then potentially in the end reach the top, where then the state leaders, or in the case of the PLO, the leader of this particular organization, try to strike a deal. Then when you have these people sitting together, then obviously retrospectively the key managers, like in this particular case, when you take the Camp David agreement, say retrospectively that the particular strategy that they have chosen was key to making this mediation success. And this you see here summarized then in the statement by President Carter, who then also asked them that they should have something that they can bring back to their grandchildren, so that the grandchildren could be proud. And then President Carter wrote individual text for all kids. And only because of this intervention, that is at least how President Carter told it afterwards, so we cannot really trust whether this was the case, but only this intervention, this direct intervention involving emotions, was successful. And as you know, President Carter then was the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. It could not be shared with President Sadat, obviously, because he was killed in an Islamist attack. And President Begin, as you know, was the mastermind behind the King David terrorist attack in the 1940s. So he would also have not have qualified for the Nobel Peace Prize. So being a successful mediator can bring some applause in the long run. Okay, let's move towards our theoretical understanding of mediations. What are the conditions under which they are successful? And what has played a big role here in this literature is the metaphor introduced by Bill Zartman two decades ago, which he called the hurting stalemate. And according to him, only when the conflict parties are at this hurting stalemate, they do not really know how to end the conflict, because both sides do not really believe that they can that easily win this conflict, then they agree on mediation. And they perceive then mediation as a way out of the conflict. So this is one influential explanation for that. We also have other explanations. There's a rich empirical literature that, for instance, looks at the size of the mediation team, the power of the mediator. Only powerful mediators can credibly threaten the two varying parties. Then what plays a role is whether or not the mediator engages into such a forceful strategy or not, and then the question on whether mediators are neutral or not. One of our former doctoral students, Konstantin Ruhe, has examined the ripeness of the conflict, and he has qualified this ripeness to a certain extent. So he has looked with substate data on the conditions on whether or not mediations are successful or not. And what you see here is that it matters where the mediation attempts take place. This means then that the average distance from the capital has to be taken into account, and this you see on the figure here, but then you get in the end this average distance. If the mediation attempt takes place, for instance, the capital, which is controlled by the government, it's very unlikely that this will be successful. But when the mediation attempt is somewhere further out in the side, and the conflict is at an impasse out there, then such a mediation might be successful. And so this is what he finds in the data in his doctoral dissertation and in his article published in the Journal of Peace Research. Ruhe also corrected an interpretation by Birdsley, this name you have heard beforehand when I talked about UN interventions. Birdsley made the argument that mediation is successful in the long run, but not necessarily in the long run. And so there might be a recurrence of a conflict after certain years. Mediation, according to him, does not change this, but Konstantin Ruhe has shown that there are certain statistical weaknesses in the analysis of Birdsley, so this is not necessarily the case. So mediation is a successful strategy, according to him, both in the short run and also then in the long run. Another question that is important here in the literature is on whether or not a mediator shall be neutral or not. And as you recall from the picture that I had previously on here, is the question on whether the mediator should be situated in the middle between these two sides and be unbiased, or whether it might be helpful to be, at least to a certain extent, be biased in a certain direction. And the main contributions to this question are by Andrew Kidd, and these are largely theoretical analysis, formal analysis. And he made an argument that it might be helpful that there is at least a certain bias, because if you are completely neutral, then the mediation attempt does not provide any information to the two sides. If now a biased mediator makes a recommendation, so it's closer, this actor C is closer to actor A, that goes in the direction of finding a conflict, that solution that is closer to the interest of actor B, then overcoming this bias reveals that this is a mediator which is trustful and credible. So bias does not necessarily undermine successful mediation attempts, but obviously it is then questionable whether very biased mediators, like currently the United States in the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, will be very helpful in the short run, but also in the long run. So the question here is about building trust in helping actors in overcoming the problem of uncertainty in such a situation. But I want you to ponder here in the mini break is why then certain mediators criticize publicly the disputants. And one anecdote here is Margaret Albright, State Secretary of the United States, meaning Foreign Minister of the United States under President Clinton, and she publicly scolded the Israeli and the Palestinians that she's sick and tired of the way that they are behaving and not making progress. Typically, such scolding would be a matter of private diplomacy, but here it is in the open. And why does an experienced mediator, an experienced negotiator like Madeleine Albright choose such mediation strategy? So think about that. Welcome again. This is the last part of session 12, and I will talk about peacekeeping and also interventions. What you have to distinguish is peacekeeping from peacemaking. Peacekeeping is the less active strategy, and it's the more common strategy by the United Nations, but also by regional organizations. So it intervenes after a conflict, sends troops to keep the conflict parties apart from each other. Peacemaking, the UN also has the right to intervene, or it can delegate the right to intervene in certain conflicts, as it delegated such powers to the United States and its allies in the Korean War, but also in the first Iraqi war. So this is then peacemaking. These are direct interventions. Peace building, this is the long-term strategy of how a society can be made peaceful, or at least less conflictual, after a conflict has ended. The UN, as you know from the first part of today's session, has become very involved in peacekeeping, especially after the end of the Cold War. And during this post-Cold War era, it has also changed how it designs such peacekeeping missions based on some bad and unsuccessful experiences. Some of these intervening forces by the UN or other organizations last very long. Think about Cyprus, think about Korea, and other ones have a more short-termish nature. In the beginning, especially because of this long peacekeeping periods, the literature was quite pessimistic and believed that these attempts do not make these countries peaceful in the long run. And now the literature has become much more optimistic and believes that indeed it can be, peacekeeping can be a first step towards peace. What we also observe here is that it's not only that individual missions are compared against each other, but people look at how the situation evolves at the sub-state level. And here you have studies by Handorus, Andrea Ruggieri, and Ismene Gizelis, for instance, who have contributed such studies. When you look at peacekeeping, is what you see here, that quite some developing countries are active on this front. And especially the permanent members of the Security Council are not that heavily involved. Quite some of them are the largest arms manufacturers, so they are fueling the conflicts, but they are not that much engaged then in peacekeeping missions. Why do we have here developing countries that are very active? They also have pecuniary interests. They can use their troops and they get some monetary compensation to that. Obviously, when you look at peace making and the alliance that the United States built with the formal powers coming from the United Nations, then you see here that the largest bulk came then simultaneously from the of soldiers and also of armaments and so on, came from the United States, but also Saudi Arabia was heavily involved in this particular conflict. And as I said, here you have peacekeeping missions around the world and sometimes for decades. What you also observe here that currently you find such missions, especially in Africa. Why that? Simply because here the interests of the permanent members of the Security Council are then quite often not that salient, meaning that they then agree on such a mission coming from the United Nations. In the beginning, as I said beforehand, the literature was quite pessimistic. By different studies by Virginia Page Fortner from Columbia University on New York and some other researchers, this negative perception of this conflict management tool has been altered. And she basically says that since the end of the Cold War, these missions have changed and have become more successful. They prevent conflicts from recurring, at least to a certain extent. So, and she ends here a paragraph in one of her articles where she says that we can thus be quite confident in the finding that peacekeeping helps maintain peace. This you see here on this particular slide. What she examines here are the hazards of peace or conflict. So you look just at the duration of the spell of peace after a conflict has ended and after the United Nations or other organizations have put their troops on the ground. And first she examines then here the impact of peacekeeping, and you see here the impact is both for the entire post-World War II period significant and positive. And what she then also does is that she looks at the post-Cold War period and comes up with similar findings. And she particularly examines what is called multidimensional peacekeeping. And this means that you have differently or missions which are designed in a complex fashion, that you do not simply try to keep the troops from the different sides apart, but that you also engage much more than into what is also called then peace building. Then you see also here that other factors play a big role in that. Okay, what also plays a role is that obviously the engagement of the international community plays a bigger role. And this engagement can be expressed simply by the number of troops on the ground. Lisa Hultman from the University of Uppsala and colleagues from American universities have found strong evidence that the more troops are deployed, the lower is the risk of massive civilian victimization. And this you see here in this graph, the estimation that they conducted through this simulation here. And they speak of a dramatical effect. When you do a substate analysis, as Rubieri, Dorussen, and Gizelis have done, you find a very similar effects. So it matters where the UN puts its troops and how strong the forces then are. So only a few troops, and think again about Rwanda and the absence of an intervention, a strong intervening force can make a large difference in this event. Okay, such interventions have their particular price. And what is now well known through different scandals is that such peacekeeping also creates adverse incentive structures for the local population, for the local industry. So there is a study by Bernd Beber and colleagues published in International Organization looking at prostitution in Liberia, and they see then through the deployment of UN forces, prostitution and all the ills that are associated with prostitutions have been growing in this post-conflict society. And this is quite often an attribute of interventions, sometimes also of foreign aid, that it creates the wrong incentives. I was once in a discussion with journalists in Brussels, and they reported to me how a certain mission from the United Nations in Afghanistan has failed. So the United Nations bought back Kalashnikovs from Afghan soldiers and rebels. And the price was about $100 for each Kalashnikov that was delivered to the United Nations. The problem was that the street price for Kalashnikovs was much lower. So the scheme by the United Nations created the incentive to produce more Kalashnikovs or to bring them over the borders. So interventions can have side effects and can have social ills like prostitutions, like the study by Beber and colleagues has shown. Peacemaking or intervention is then much more controversial nowadays than peacekeeping. So there is a literature starting out in the 1990s that has examined then whether or not military interventions make then states more peaceful. I just take here a quote from Bruce Russert, and he believes that this is a strategy that will ultimately fail, and he says that the model of fight them, beat them, and make them democratic is irrevocably flawed as a basis for policy. You recall from our discussions when I presented the so-called democratic peace thesis that President Wilson spoke or had the slogan for World War I, to make the world safe for democracy. Something similar was taken up by the administration of the second Bush, George W. Bush. He propagated an attempt then to make the Middle East democratic. This has been contested. Bruce Russert said early on, such attempts will not be successful. But there have been then empirical Studies, Pekkanen and Pickering, for instance, believe that UN interventions are more successful or more effective by making peace than interventions by single states. But these findings are controversial. I will just present here one study by Bruce Buena de Mesquita. So this is the father, Buena de Mesquita. For terrorism studies, you have also Ethan Buena de Mesquita together with Downs. And they make the argument that, yes, it is then interventions by the United States that lead to democracy, but not necessarily interventions by the United Nations. So they have then adverse impact. They believe that these US interventions are just much more credible, stronger than the other ones. They also believe that there is a selection effect. The United States take on the cases that are hardest to solve and where the interventions that can really make a difference. And this is shown in their particular table here. And you see here that they have quite a strong effect on democracy 10 years after the intervention has been starting. The size of the coalition has also increased, and there is more competition, and there is more participation in these societies. So this leads then to the literature on peace building, and this is now the more long-termist strategy in general. So can certain designs of post-war orders make such war-torn societies more peaceful? And I will just present some studies. What is important here, according to Michael Doyle and Nicholas Sambanis, is that international factors play a role, and that the opposition is able to participate. So let's look then at the influential peace-building triangle by Doyle and Sambanis. They find evidence that you need to have international capacity, meaning a commitment by international organization or individual states. You need local capacities, and you need then to have low hostility at the beginning of such a process. And according to this, their simulations, all three factors are equally important in bringing peace to a country. So local capacity also means that you have a growing economy and so on. And you need to solve certain societal problems. So after a conflict has ended, you have a much higher incidence, for instance, of post-traumatic stress disorders in a society. So also do not need to only to let the economy grow, but you need to heal these particular wounds, and especially the latter. These psychological aspects are not sufficiently addressed in the literature. Finally, let's look then on what guarantees here that you have a reduction in the risk that war breaks out again in the site, the design of the peace treaties. And here is a study by Michaela Mattes and Burcu Savun. Michaela Mattes, a German, is now a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. So what these two scholars stress is that you need to reduce the uncertainty. And just recall here from the initial graph that I had here on the whiteboard, that there needs to be a lot of information about what the other side does, what its strengths is, that arms are really then delivered, and that these groups are disarmed. What is also important here when you look at the hazard trades is power sharing, an issue that I have discussed beforehand. So if such a peace agreement includes power sharing provisions, this makes it a lot less likely that a conflict then will recur again. You see here that local conditions like life expectancy and so on also play a role, but also some attributes of the conflict situation, whether there is whether ethnicity is an important topic or not, plays a big role, and how costly the previous war has been. Okay, so this was session 12. Thank you, and I will then see you again at some point for session 13.